This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Time just flies. How can it be 40 years since Jessica Lange was first on a movie screen, a wide-eyed ingenue making her debut in the clutches of King Kong? Just like that, the ingenue was a grande dame, an actress with an incredible list of roles behind her. Now Lange is playing another leading lady, Joan Crawford, in the amazing TV series Feud, directed by Ryan Murphy. Lange co-stars with Susan Sarandon, who's Betty Davis. And the show is a look at the psychological toll that Hollywood took on actresses of that generation. Lange recently sat down to talk with The New Yorker's theater critic Hilton Auls, and they started at the very beginning. Lange dropped out of college in Minnesota to work on a documentary about flamenco dancers. It was the late 60s. Lange was now in Europe, broke, free as a bird, and loving every minute of it.
We're driving up in a Land Rover from southern Spain to Amsterdam, and came into Paris in May of 1968, which was the students and workers, and there was the whole revolution basically going on in the city of Paris. And I thought, this is the most thrilling thing I have ever seen in my life. Whoa. And I want to come back and live in Paris. So about 2 years later, I did. I moved back to Paris after having become aware of Etienne de Crewe, who mm-hmm. was a great kind of the master mime. Yeah. It wasn't pantomime in the way that you think of Marcel Marceau or, you know, that kind of street mime. This was very classical. Mm-hmm. And we worked extremely hard on the tiniest little things. And I never wanted to leave, but at some point I thought, well, I've got to go back because I don't know what I can do with this
information.
Yeah, and this practice that I'm, like, obsessed with. So I went back to New York, got a job at the Lion's Head, waiting tables, serving drinks to all the crazy writers that were hanging out in there in those days, and started taking acting classes. And somehow with the acting, everything kind of came together. As much as I had loved the mime, it felt like there was something, some element that was not there.
Words, do you think?
Yes, I think it was. Because I remember the very first scene I did from The Dutchman, Leroy Jones play.
Oh, my God, that is one of my favorite.
Yeah.
You know, he wrote that in a day.
Did he really? I didn't know that.
He wrote that play, and it has some of the most extraordinary language about violence, right?
Yes. And the young man that I was working with, we were rehearsing in this apartment that I was subletting on the ground floor, and we were rehearsing this scene, and suddenly there was like this pounding on the door.
Whoa.
And one of the neighbors had called the police because they thought that I was in trouble.
Whoa.
Because she's accusing him of rape and everything.
That's right.
And so the police came in, and it was like, so this is the power of text. I get it.
Whoa.
And I think really partly what happened was the idea of voice. When are you going to learn, Edie? You can have your cake and eat it too in this life.
No, you can't, Mother darling.
Edie. Find a man who'll give you a long leash. Get married. And then you can do whatever you want.
I remember when I was doing Grey Gardens, I would come to the trailer in the morning before I'd go into hair and makeup. And I would just put on, either a DVD or a CD of Big Edie speaking. Mm-hmm. And it would take me about 5 or 10 minutes, and I could feel her voice kind of settle down and deep inside me.
Yes.
And as soon as that happened, I had the character. But it was always through the voice.
Yes.
Yeah, and the same was true with Joan, although her voice, what became interesting about the voice was the pretense.
Yes.
Was the performance.
That's right.
Because obviously, I mean, she was from San Antonio, Texas, dirt poor.
Yes.
No education whatsoever. When she talked about coming to Hollywood and first reading scripts, she'd have to sit with a dictionary because she knew so little vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
So when she arrives at MGM, you know, and she's working her way up, suddenly it's talkies and suddenly she's a starlet. And I think she embraced that whole MGM speak.
Mm-hmm.
150%,
mm-hmm.
so that she could always feel above her station in a way.
How does it feel when you, every character is different, but when you play quote unquote real life persons?
I find in a way playing real characters more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple reasons. One, because it pushes you to get it as perfect, as close to perfect as you can within what you're able to do and what's written. But also for instance, with Joan, which was amazing, was the idea that you were playing Joan Crawford. You were actually Lucille Lesueur playing Joan Crawford.
Yes.
So you had layers.
Yes.
You had layers that were happening all the time, simultaneously.
Guess what, Betty?
I have finally found the perfect project for the two of us. It's always been my dream to work with you. Do you remember how I begged Jack Warner to put us together in Ethan Frome?
With Mr. Gary Cooper.
You do remember.
You wanted to play the pretty young servant girl, and I was to play the old hag of a wife. Forget it.
But this is different. These are the parts of a lifetime.
No thanks, Lucille. I've got plenty of better offers.
I know what kind of offers you've been getting. Exactly none, because the same is true for me. They're not making women's pictures anymore. Not the
and
kind we used
for her, the stakes were so high.
Mm-hmm.
She never let her guard down. In any interview that I ever watched of hers, except there was a radio interview. She arrived at an airport and she was obviously drunk. The drunk interviews are great. The drunk interviews were really, whoa. But she was doing her best to be Joan Crawford.
Yes.
And she's talking and she's doing her best MGM speak, and mm-hmm. you can hear how hard she's working because she's obviously drunk.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, these children come up and she turns to them and she says, "How are you?" Yeah, I don't think you can take the Texas out of them.
Tell me, how did the project come about with your adorable Ryan Murphy? Actually, I'm longing to know how you and Ryan started anyway, because it was started with American Horror.
Well, that was just out of the blue, really.
Yeah.
Since I don't watch TV, mm-hmm. I wasn't really aware of who Ryan was. But the phone rings, it's Ryan Murphy, and we start talking. And he was so funny. He said, "Do this with me," he said. "I'm going to write you the greatest parts, and you're going to win all the awards, and you'll make a lot of money." And he was like, just one thing after another. I mean, he is a master.
Seduction.
Yes.
Yes.
Seducer.
Tell me about the great genius Bob Fosse. I love you so much as Angelique, and we're talking about all that jazz.
Yeah.
Where Jessica plays the very fetching
angel
of death.
Yes. Well, I mean, he saw me in King Kong, and where so many people just more or less dismissed me. But Fosse really, he made a point of reaching out to me and wrote that part for me. I mean, obviously, it was a musical, and it was a Fosse musical, and I don't sing or dance or do any of that. So, but he wanted to help me, I think. And so this was what he came up with, because that was really the second film I did.
It was your second film, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that Meryl Streep had seen De Laurentiis for King Kong? Did you know that?
People have mentioned that to me over time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And she said something in Italian, thinking that she didn't understand.
Oh.
And she said, "I'm sorry I disappoint you."
But, you know, the truth is he didn't want to test me either.
He didn't?
No. I had come back to New York. I was studying with Herbert Berghoff, and I was approached by this Wilhelmina, who's a modeling agent, saying, "I understand you're studying acting. We've been contacted by Dino De Laurentiis. They're casting. They want to cast an unknown for the remake of King Kong." I thought, ho, ho, ho. This is not of interest to me at all.
Right.
But
I like my basement with my Dutchman. Yeah.
That's right. But they were paying for me to fly to California.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, okay, well, I want to get to California because my sister's living on a sailboat out there. And I haven't seen her for a while, so this would be great. I could, like, you know, maybe get on the boat and sail with her for a while. They took one look at me and were not in the least bit interested.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, somebody said, "You flew her out there. Just put her on camera."
Mm-hmm.
So I went in the morning, and I had a scene to play. Neither the producer, nor the director, nor the first assistant director, none of the writer, nobody was there.
Oh, no, Jessica.
Yeah,
oh.
No. And there was just some
hair and makeup
skeleton
person.
Crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a scene. And the next thing I know, they've got the first assistant director there. The first AD comes in and watches. And after lunch, John Gillerman, the director, shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing I know, there's De Laurentiis.
Wow.
I mean, they offered me the part before I even left town.
And how did you know how to play it to the camera?
I don't think I did. I had this certain naivete, I guess. This
lack of self-consciousness.
Yeah. And not really an awareness. No self-awareness in doing it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you did become more aware of it as the work went on, or is it something that you can shut out very easily?
Well, now, I mean, the camera becomes almost like a lover in a way. It's that thing of them gazing upon you, and you really kind of flowering for them.
Yes.
It was different when the director used to be right next to the camera, which was then it became this kind of alchemy, this exchange of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And you were doing it for the camera and for him.
Mm-hmm. He was the audience.
Yes. And there was a, you know, there was a sensual feeling to the scene, because his head would be right there next to the lens.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, once it became Video Village and the director was off in another room, then it all became the camera.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard to be in that reality and to also have children?
Well, yes. It's very difficult, I think. And that's another thing I think we touch on in Feud.
Completely.
Is how do you balance a career and ambition and desire and the need to make a living? How do you balance that with being a good mother? I mean, it was always torturous for me. It really was. I never found a way to do it and feel at ease and that I was doing justice to either one, really.
Mm-hmm.
When it came right down to it, the choice was always my children, was always my family.
Yes.
And I think in some way, you know, your career suffers for that.
Yes.
But in the long run, I'd rather look back and say, oh, I didn't do that part because I didn't want to, you know, whatever, than to say, oh, those were the biggest regrets. Why did I do that and spend that time away?
Jessica Lange talking with The New Yorker's Hilton Alls. She was recently seen in Louis C.K.'s series Horace and Pete, and she co-stars in the series Feud.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.